Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. A flashpoint from Africa to report as we still observe the repercussions from the Friday attacks in Paris. As we've reported, gunmen stormed the Radisson Blue Hotel in Bamako, Mali, a group which claims affiliation with Al-Qaeda but is part of a localized insurgency in Mali and northwest Africa, took nearly 140 people hostage at one point. Hours later, Malian special forces, with French and U.S. forces involved in some unspecified way, cleared the hotel and freed the hostages, although dozens of people have been killed. Mali has seen this kind of thing before. Militants actually seized territory in the northern part of the country until President François Hollande ordered hundreds of French troops into the region in early 2013. Today, a standoff ends and continued talk of closed borders and heightened security around the world. Rob writes us on Facebook, blaming the victims rather than the perpetrators is emotional-charged political demagoguery and is extremely dangerous and deadly to people and nations as a whole. Carolyn writes on our site, freedom is very important and it is disarming to people who have not experienced it when ISIS frightens everyone, including governments, to the point that people in free and democratic countries are bent in fear, then the enemy has won. ISIS or ISIL or Daesh, whatever you call them, does fear of them constitute a victory? Is a military option exactly what ISIS wants from the West? Recognition through confrontation. In that case, this may be the opening. The Pope has called this new violence a new piecemeal Third World War. Gideon Rockman is chief foreign affairs columnist for the Financial Times. Gideon, is the Pope right?
Personally, I would try to avoid that kind of language because I think it plays into the hands of the group themselves, Islamic State, who have very grandiose views of themselves and would like to believe that they're engaged in a global struggle against the West, against infidels, or however you want to put it. I mean, but that said, I think that obviously there is something that is a global problem now. We've seen the attacks in Paris. There are also attacks going on in Mali as I speak on Friday. There are the terrorism problems clearly in the Middle East. The Russian plane was downed in Sinai just a week before the attacks in Paris. But I mean, if you think about it, really all the major powers have a problem with Islamist terrorism. So America was hit on 9/11. The Indians were hit in Mumbai in 2008 in an attack that was very similar to Paris. The Chinese would claim that they too have a problem with Islamist terrorism in Xinjiang. So there is clearly a global aspect to this problem, but I wouldn't dignify it with the phrase Third World War.
Let's look at it in three different ways here. And it seems to me that there are basically three different ways of looking at this. On the one hand, you can view this as a military tactical encounter with a group that's centered in the Middle East. And so therefore, if you somehow strangle it in the Middle East, you'll reduce its ability to do anything in a coordinated way. And that's kind of conventional war. And the second way of looking at this is to see it as a kind of broad criminality. That essentially the 21st century is going to be filled with a sort of, you know, crime wave that includes this kind of terrorism from a variety of sources, and they may seem like they're all part of one conspiracy someday, and the next day they're going to be just whoever can get their hands on AK-47s at any given moment, and that the world is just going to have to deal with that. And then the third way of looking at this is that there's some kind of realignment where the Muslim world or the allegedly aggrieved South world that includes a lot of Muslims is going to acquire some level of prosperity or inclusion that's going to diffuse all of this, that the anger will sort of go away. Which of these is the end game here?
I think that, look, they think that they, you know, insofar as the ideology makes any sense at all, that they do have a view that they can achieve some kind of victory, that they will establish a caliphate. You know, to you and I, that sounds like a kind of crazy fantasy, but it's enough to keep these people to have a vision and to drive forward with it. I mean, just on back on the question of tackling it in terms of a terror threat, I think that one of the disturbing aspects of the Paris attacks is that if you talk to people, the intelligence people who try to monitor these things, they have generally thought that what we're most vulnerable to, particularly in Europe, is a small attack where it's one or two people who don't do much organisation. But they thought that if it was a big plot with like 8-9 people, many months of preparation, multiple targets, they would pick that up because of the monitoring, because of the number of the infiltration of terrorist groups, because of electronic communications and so on. And they regularly roll up these plots. There are many more of them that are planned than actually succeed. So it's a bit concerning that you could have a big plot like this that went undetected for a long time and then actually blew up.
Is there any value, before we go, in just ignoring all of this?
I don't think you can ignore it in a democracy, because your citizens will demand that you respond. But I think that you may have to live with it. I don't think that politicians can put it that way, because understandably voters will say, fine, you know, I'm not prepared to live with it, so I'm going to turn to somebody who can promise me that we can eradicate it. I don't think, you know, I think that it's been interesting for me actually to be in the US this week, having come from Europe, because there is still a demand for kind of absolute security here, which I think that the Europeans have sadly more or less given up on. I mean, I think we kind of accept that we are susceptible to terrorism and that you do your level best to sort of clamp it down, but it's going to come back. Whereas here, you see it in the refugee debate, the idea that if you could say, okay, no Syrian refugees will come in here, that will make you safe. And I think that...
It's preposterous. It's preposterous on its face.
Yeah, I think it is pretty preposterous, yeah, to be honest. I'm trying to be polite, but it's also it doesn't even make sense as a security measure, because
not the enemy. They're in fact fleeing the enemy.
They're fleeing the enemy, and also that, you know, if you're IS and you want to infiltrate terrorists into America, God forbid, you would send a French citizen or a Belgian citizen who can come in without need for a visa. You wouldn't ask for a Syrian refugee who would have to go through 2 years of vetting. It really doesn't make sense. But
so as a foreign affairs columnist for the Financial Times, the folks at ISIS must be looking at this debate in the United States and this "we will make you safe with security" and just be high fiving and laughing their heads off.
I don't know whether they do much high fiving, but I think that they. You know, the reason I hesitate about all this, you know, Third World War rhetoric is that they definitely want. That's something they would agree with. And they, insofar as there is a kind of political goal behind attacks like Paris, it is to create no kind of middle ground, to radicalize everyone on every side so that everybody in the community that feels attacked is asking for more radical measures. And that then makes it extremely hard to be a moderate Muslim if you feel that your whole community has been stigmatized and so on. And then that feeds the narrative that IS want, which is that there is an inevitable conflict between Muslims and the West. And that, you know, although there may be people in our societies who are now coming around to that point of view, if you think it through for a while, there can be no future, peaceful future for Europe, certainly, if that's the case. Something like 5% of the population of my own country are Muslims, 10% of the population of France are Muslims. You know, I live and work alongside these people. There's no need to believe that there's an absolute conflict. That's just not a description of reality. But to the extent that IS can create those ideas through these horrific attacks and then through the reactions they spark, that, I think, is insofar as there's a rationale, that's what it is. And so we really have to be careful about, well, obviously ramping up security measures and perhaps also attacking them in Syria and Iraq, not feeding this narrative that they want, which is that Islam and the West are heading for an inevitable showdown.
I think that's the key point, the feeding the narrative piece. And so far this week, they're doing a pretty good job, I would have to say. Gideon Rachman, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Gideon Rachman is chief foreign affairs columnist for the Financial Times. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C.